Crafting strategy. A well-thought-out and logical strategy will enable your group to accomplish its objectives and contribute to the larger organization's competitive edge. A strategy defines what your organization will do and, critically, what it won't do. The fundamental strategic questions concern customers, capital, capabilities, and commitments. Use the following list to quickly sketch out your unit strategy. Number 1. Customers. Which set of existing customers will we continue to serve? Which markets are we going to exit? What new markets are we going to enter, and when are we going to do it? Number 2. Capital. Of the businesses we will remain in, which will we invest in and which will we draw cash from? What additional capital is likely to be required and when? Where will it come from? Number 3. Capabilities. What are we good at and not good at? What existing organizational capabilities, for example, a strong new product development organization, can we leverage? Which do we need to build up? Which do we need to create or acquire? Number 4. Commitments. What critical resource commitment decisions do we need to make? When? What difficult-to-reverse past commitments do we have to live with or try to unwind? It is beyond the scope of this audiobook to delve deeply into business strategy, but excellent resources are available to help you answer these questions. Our focus here is on assessing strategy by looking at its coherence, adequacy, and implementation. Assessing coherence. Does a logic underlie the market segment of choices, products, technologies, plans, and goals that compose the strategy? Assessing whether the elements of a strategy fit together calls for looking at the logic behind it to ensure that it makes sense overall. Have the people who developed the strategy thought through all its ramifications and the practical aspects of implementing it? How do you evaluate a strategy's logic? Start by looking at documents that describe your group's strategy, such as strategic plans and mission statements. Then disassemble the strategy into its components: markets, products, technologies, functional plans, and goals. Ask yourself, do the various dimensions of the strategy support one another? Is there a logical thread connecting these various parts? To be more specific, is there an obvious connection between market analysis and the group's objectives? Does the product development budget jibe with the capital investments projected in the operations part of the strategy? Are plans in place to prepare salespeople for new products in the pipeline? If the strategy makes sense overall, you will spot such connections easily. Assessing adequacy. Is the strategy sufficient for what the group needs to do in the next 2 to 3 years? Will the strategy help your group support the larger organization's goals? Your group's strategy may be well thought through and logically integrated, but is it also adequate? That is, will it empower the group to carry out what it needs to do to succeed and to help the larger organization succeed in the next 2 to 3 years? To assess adequacy, use these 3 approaches. Number 1. Ask some probing questions. Does your boss believe the strategy will provide enough return on the effort your group will expend to implement it? Are there plans in place to secure, develop, and preserve resources with which to carry out the strategy? Are profit and other targets high enough to keep the group on the right track? Is enough money earmarked for capital investment, for research? Number 2. Use the well-known SWOT method. Analyze the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats associated with the strategy. Here's an example of each. 1. A strategy's strength. Flexibility to develop and launch new products in response to rapid changes in customer preferences. A strategy weakness: over-reliance on a few aging products. A strategy opportunity: a new market that your group might serve by extending an existing brand. A strategic threat: a competitor that is entering a core market with a superior new technology. Number 3. Probe the history of the strategy's creation. Find out who drove the strategy development process. Did they rush the process? Drag it out? If the former, they might not have thought through all the ramifications. If the latter, it might represent a lowest common denominator compromise that emerged from a political battle. Any mistakes during the development process could compromise the strategy's adequacy. Assessing implementation. Has the strategy been implemented energetically? If not, why not? Next, look at how your group's strategy is being implemented, what people are doing, not what they're saying. Doing so will help you pinpoint whether problems stem from inadequacies in strategy formulation or strategy implementation. Ask yourself these kinds of questions. Are the performance metrics specified in the strategy used to make day-to-day decisions? Are the performance aspects that management actually uses consistent with the strategy's emphasis? What goals does the organization seem to be pursuing? If the strategy requires teamwork and cross-functional integration, are people acting as teams and collaborating across functions? If the strategy requires new employee skills, is a training and development infrastructure in place to develop these skills? Your answers to these kinds of questions will tell you whether to push for changes in your group's stated strategy or in its implementation of the strategy. Modifying strategy. Suppose you discover serious flaws in the strategy you have inherited. Can you radically change the strategy or the way it is implemented? That depends on two factors: the STARS situation you are entering and your ability to persuade others and build support for your ideas. Proposing significant changes to strategy is most difficult in realignments. You have to convince people who believe that their unit or team is already performing well using existing approaches. If you believe that the strategy has put the group on the wrong path, your main job will be to raise questions to persuade your boss and others to re-examine the strategy. You can ask questions such as the following. Number one, if we were to achieve this plan, what might some of the unintended results be? Number two, I see this plan is aimed at serving a broader market. Is that what we want? Number three, this plan is aggressive. What other goals will we need to put on hold to achieve it? If you conclude that the existing strategy will move the group forward, but neither fast enough nor far enough, the wisest course may be to tweak it early on and plan for bigger changes later. For example, you might raise the targeted revenue goals modestly, or recommend investing in a needed technology sooner than the strategy calls for. More fundamental changes should wait until you've learned more and built support among key constituencies. Shaping your group's structure. Once you have clarified what changes your group's strategy needs, you can address structural changes to support the desired strategy. What is structure exactly? Most simply, your group's structure is the way it organizes people and technology to support its strategy. Structure consists of the following elements. Number one, units. How your direct reports are grouped, such as by function, product, or geographical area. Number two, decision rights. Who is empowered to make what kinds of decisions and how? Number three, performance measurement and reward systems. What performance evaluation metrics and reward systems are in place? Number four, reporting relationships and information sharing mechanisms. How people observe and control the way work gets done and how they share information and make high-level decisions. Assessing structure. Before you begin to generate ideas for reshaping your group's structure, look into how the four structural elements interact. Are the pieces out of tune or in harmony? Ask yourself, number one, does the way team members are grouped help us achieve our strategic goals? Are the right people in the right places to work towards our core objectives? Number two, is our decision-making structure letting us make the best decisions efficiently? Number three, are we measuring and rewarding the kinds of achievements that matter most to our strategic aims? Number four, do our reporting relationships promote sharing the right information at the right time and monitoring work in a way that supports our strategy? If you are in a startup situation, and therefore forming a new group, you will not have existing structures to evaluate. Instead, think about how you want the structural pieces to work in your group. Grappling with trade-offs. There is no perfect organization. Everyone embodies trade-offs. Thus, your challenge is to find the right balance for your situation. As you consider changes in your group's structure, keep in mind some all-too-common problems that can arise. Number one, the team's knowledge base is too narrow or broad. When you group people with similar experience and capabilities, they can accumulate deep wells of expertise. But if their knowledge base becomes too narrow and specialized, isolation and compartmentalization can result. Groups with a broad mix of skills may be able to integrate their knowledge more successfully, though at the cost of developing deeper expertise. Number two, employees' decision-making scope is too narrow or broad. A good general rule is that decisions should be made by the people who have the most relevant knowledge, so long as their incentives encourage them to do what is best for the organization. If your group's decision-making process is centralized, you, and perhaps several other individuals, can decide quickly. But you may be foregoing the benefit of the wisdom of others who are better equipped to make certain of those decisions. This structure can lead to ill-informed decisions and can tax those who make all the decisions. If, on the other hand, people are given decision-making scope but do not understand the larger implications of their choices, they may make unwise calls. Number three, employees are inappropriately rewarded. Effective managers align the interests of each decision-maker with the interests of the group as a whole. This is why team-based reward systems are effective in some organizations. They focus everyone's attention on the group's ability to work together. Problems arise when measurement and compensation schemes fail to reward employees for either their individual or their collective efforts. Problems also arise when rewards advance employees' individual interests at the expense of the group's broader goals, such as when multiple employees who could serve the same set of customers lack incentives to cooperate. This was the problem confronting Hannah Jaffe at the beginning of the chapter. Number four, reporting relationships lead to compartmentalization or diffusion of accountability. Reporting relationships help you observe and control the workings of your group, clarify responsibility, and encourage accountability. Hierarchical reporting relationships make these tasks easier, but can lead to compartmentalization and poor information sharing. More complex reporting arrangements, such as matrix structures, broaden information sharing and reduce compartmentalization, but can dangerously diffuse accountability. Aligning key systems. Systems, often also referred to as processes, enable your group to transform information, materials, and knowledge into value in the form of commercially viable products or services, new knowledge or ideas, productive relationships, or anything else the larger organization considers essential. Again, as with structure, ask yourself whether the processes currently in place support the strategy. That is, will those processes enable your group to meet or even exceed the goals laid out in the strategy? Keep in mind that the extent and types of processes you need depend on whether your primary goal is to drive flawless execution or stimulate innovation. You can't hope to achieve high levels of quality and reliability and low costs without an intensive focus on developing processes that specify both the ends and the means, methods, techniques, tools, in exquisite detail. Obvious examples of this are manufacturing plants and service delivery organizations. But these same sorts of processes can impede innovation. So if stimulating innovation is your goal, you need to develop processes that focus more on defining ends and rigorously checking progress towards achieving them at key milestones, and not so much on controlling means. Doing process analysis. A credit card company that sought to identify its fundamental processes came up with the results shown in Table 6-1, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program. They then mapped and improved each of these processes, developing appropriate measurement schemes and altering reward systems to better align behaviors. They also focused on identifying key bottlenecks. For critical tasks that were insufficiently under control, they revamped procedures and introduced new support tools. The result was a dramatic increase in both customer satisfaction and the productivity of the organization. Your unit or group may have just as many processes as the credit card company. Your first challenge is to identify those processes and then to decide which of them are most important to your strategy. Those vital activities are your core processes. For example, suppose your group's strategy emphasizes customer satisfaction over product development. You would want to ensure that all the processes involved in the delivery of product or services to customers support that goal. Aligning systems with structure. If your group's core processes are to support its strategy, they must also align with the unit's structure, the way people and work are organized. We can compare this relationship to the human body. Our anatomy, skeleton, musculature, skin, and other components, is the structural foundation for the body's normal functions. Our physiology, circulation, respiration, digestion, and so forth, is the set of systems that enable the various parts of the body to work together. In organizations, as in human bodies, both the structure and the processes must be sound and reinforce one another. To evaluate the efficiency and effectiveness of each core process, you should examine four aspects. Number one, productivity. Does the process efficiently transform knowledge, material, and labor into value? Number two, timeliness. Does the process deliver the desired value in a timely manner? Number three, reliability. Is the process sufficiently reliable, or does it break down too often? Number four, quality. Does the process deliver value in a way that consistently meets required quality standards? When systems and structures jibe, both elements reinforce each other and the strategy. For example, a customer service organization structured around specific customer segments also shares information across teams and responds effectively to issues that affect all customer groups. When systems and structures are at odds, such as when different teams compete for the same set of customers using different sales processes, they hamstring one another and subvert the group's strategy. Improving core processes. How do you actually improve a core process? Start by making a process map, a straightforward diagram of exactly how the tasks in a particular process flow through the individuals and groups who handle them. Figure 6-2, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program, shows a simplified process map for order fulfillment. Ask the individuals responsible for each stage of the process to chart the process flow from beginning to end. Then ask the team to look for bottlenecks and problem interfaces between individuals responsible for adjacent sets of tasks. For example, errors or delays may occur when someone in customer relations communicates the need for special handling of an order to the fulfillment group. Process failures are commonplace during handoffs of this kind. Work with the team to identify opportunities for high-leverage improvements. Process analysis stimulates collective learning. It helps the entire group understand exactly who does what, within and between units or groups, to carry out a particular process. Creating a process map also sheds light on how problems arise. You, your boss, and your group can then decide how best to improve the process. You have two options: radical process reengineering or incremental continual improvement. A few words of caution: you are probably responsible for a number of processes. If so, manage them as a portfolio. Do not try to introduce radical changes in more than a couple of core processes at a time. Your group will not be able to absorb so much change. As mentioned previously, do not immediately automate problematic processes, a tactic that rarely solves the real problem underlying process inefficiencies. Problems with processes usually center on miscommunication, confused expectations, and misunderstanding about how the business works. Solving deeper problems will yield bigger benefits than simply resorting to automation. Developing your group's skills base. Do your direct reports have the skills and knowledge they need to perform your group's core processes superbly, and thus to support the strategy you have identified? If not, the entire fragile architecture of your group could fall apart. A skills base comprises these four types of knowledge. Number one, individual expertise, gained through training, education, and experience. Number two, relational knowledge, an understanding of how to work together to integrate individual knowledge to achieve specified goals. Number three, embedded knowledge, the core technologies on which your groups and performance depend, such as customer databases or R&D technologies. Number four, meta knowledge, The awareness of where to go to get critical information, for example, through external affiliations such as research institutions and technology partners. Identifying gaps and resources. The overarching goal of assessing your group's capabilities is to identify, number one, critical gaps between needed and existing skills and knowledge, and, number two, underutilized resources such as partially exploited technologies and squandered expertise. Closing gaps and making better use of underutilized resources can produce enormous gains in performance and productivity. To identify skills and knowledge gaps, first revisit your strategy and the core processes you identified. Ask yourself what mix of the four types of knowledge is needed to support your group's core processes. Treat this as a visioning exercise in which you imagine the ideal knowledge mix. Then assess your group's existing skills, knowledge, and technologies. What gaps do you see? Which of them can be repaired quickly, and which will take more time? To identify underutilized resources, search for individuals or groups in your unit who have performed much better than average. What has enabled them to do so? Do they enjoy resources, technologies, methods, materials, and support from key people that could be exported to the rest of your unit? Have promising product ideas been sitting on the shelf because of lack of interest or investment? Could existing production resources be adapted to serve new sets of customers? Understanding your group's culture. Culture surrounds and influences the other four elements of organizational architecture, shaping thinking about strategy, structure, systems, and skills. Indeed, the most important business problems you will face in your new situation will likely all have a cultural dimension. Your organization's culture consists of the norms and values that shape team members' behavior, attitudes, and expectations. An organization's culture cues its people about what to do and not do. Often, as discussed previously, there are fundamental assumptions about how things work that are so embedded and long-standing that people are not even aware of their existence. Cultural habits and norms have an especially frustrating way of reinforcing the status quo, no matter how much the status quo needs changing. So it is vital that you diagnose problems in your group's existing culture and address them early. Only then can the culture fully support the group's strategy and align smoothly with the other pieces of the group's architecture, structure, systems, and skills. To understand your group's culture, you must peer below the surface-level signals of group culture, such as logos, styles of dress, and ways of communicating or interacting, as well as the social norms or shared rules that guide behavior. Search for the deepest assumptions group members take for granted. For a new leader who is trying to align the various dimensions of his or her group behind the identified strategy, the most relevant assumptions involve the following. Number one, power. Who do employees think can legitimately exercise authority and make decisions? Number two, value. What actions and outcomes do employees believe create value? Value can take such forms as making profits, satisfying customers, promoting innovation, creating supportive work environments, and so forth. How do you tease out fundamental assumptions? To understand assumptions about power, look at how decisions were made in the past. For example, who deferred to whom? To understand assumptions about value, look at how people spend their time and what energizes them most. For instance, do team members seem to focus most on forging positive, collaborative relationships with one another? Do they make customer service a priority? Do they spend most of their time trying to generate promising new product ideas? Is precision in execution valued? Initiating cultural change. You can't hope to do more than diagnose the culture and begin to work on changing some behaviors in the first 90 days. The following list sets forth 5 ways to begin cultural change. Whichever methods you use, aim for cultural changes that will align with your group's strategy, structure, systems, and skills. Number 1. Change performance measures and incentives. Change the metrics by which you judge success. Then align employees' objectives with those new measures. For instance, consider changing the balance between individual and group incentives. Does success require people to work closely and coordinate with one another, for example, in a new product development team? If so, then put more weight on group incentives. Do people in your group operate independently, for example, in a sales unit? If so, and if their individual contributions to the business can be measured, then place more emphasis on individual incentives. Number two, set up pilot projects. Give employees opportunities to experiment with new tools and behaviors. For example, set up a task force to experiment with an innovative approach to production or to tackle problems with distribution. Number three, bring in new people. Judiciously bring in people from the outside to stimulate creative thinking and discipline among group members. A new person could be a substance expert in a key area. For example, new product development or R&D management. Alternatively, you could bring in a process consultant, someone with a strong business background, but who focuses on running the process of group dialogue and supports your efforts to implement change. Number four, promote collective learning. Expose group members to new ways of operating and thinking about the business. For instance, new perspectives on customers and competitors. One idea is to engage in some benchmarking of best-in-class organizations. Number five, engage in collective visioning. Find ways to bring people together in creative ways specifically to envision new approaches to doing things. For example, schedule an off-site meeting to brainstorm ideas for improving existing processes. Getting aligned. Draw on all this analysis to develop a plan for aligning your organization. If you are repeatedly frustrated in your efforts to get people to adopt to more productive behaviors, step back and ask whether organizational misalignments might be creating problems. Acceleration checklist. Number one, what are your provisional observations about misalignments among strategy, structure, systems, skills, and culture? How will you dig deeper to confirm or refine your impressions? Number two, what decisions about customers, capital, capabilities, and commitments do you need to make? How and when will you make these decisions? Number three, what is your current assessment of the coherence of the organization's strategy? Of its adequacy? What are your current thoughts about changing your organization's strategy? Number four, what are the strengths and weaknesses of the organization's structure? What are you thinking about potential structural changes? Number five, what are the core processes in your organization? How well are they performing? What are your priorities for process improvement? Number six, what skill gaps and underutilized resources have you identified? What are your priorities for strengthening the skill base? Number seven, what are the functional and dysfunctional elements of the culture? What can you begin to do to change the culture? Chapter 7, Build Your Team. When Liam Geffen was appointed to lead a troubled unit of an instrumentation company, he knew he was in for an uphill climb. The extent of the challenge became clearer when he read the previous year's performance evaluations for his new team. Everyone was either outstanding or marginal. There was nobody in between. Clearly, his predecessor had played favorites. Conversations with his new direct reports confirmed Liam's suspicion that the performance evaluations were skewed. In particular, the head of marketing seemed reasonably competent but by no means a minor god. Unfortunately, he believed his own press. The head of sales struck Liam as a solid performer who had been blamed for poor judgment calls by Liam's predecessor. The relationship between marketing and sales was understandably tense. Liam recognized that one or both would probably have to go. He met with them separately and bluntly told them how he viewed their performance ratings. He then laid out detailed 2-month plans for each. Meanwhile, he and his VP for Human Resources quietly launched a search for a new head of marketing. Liam also held skip-level meetings with mid-level people in sales, both to assess the depth of talent and to look for promising candidates for the top job. By the end of his 3rd month, Liam had signaled the head of marketing that he would not make it. He soon left. Meanwhile, the head of sales had risen to Liam's challenge. Liam gave her more opportunities, eliciting even better performance. Eventually, Liam had enough confidence in her to give her overall responsibility for sales and marketing. Liam Geffen recognized that he couldn't afford to have the wrong people on his team. If, like him, you inherit a group of direct reports, it is essential to build your team to marshal the talent you need to achieve superior results. The most important decisions you make in your first 90 days will probably be about people on your team. If you succeed in creating a high-performance team, you can exert tremendous leverage and value creation. If not, you will face severe difficulties, for no leader can hope to achieve much alone. Bad early personnel choices will almost certainly haunt you. As one experienced manager put it, hire in haste, repent at leisure. Finding the right people is essential, but it is not enough. Begin by assessing existing team members to decide who will stay and who will have to go. Then devise a plan for getting new people and moving the people you retain into the right positions, without doing too much damage to short-term performance in the process. Even this is not enough. You still need to put in place goals, incentives, and performance measures that will propel your team in the desired directions. Finally, you must establish new processes to promote teamwork. This chapter will walk you through these steps. Avoiding common traps. Many new leaders stumble when it comes to building a winning team. The result may be a significant delay in reaching the break-even point, or it may be outright derailment. These are some of the characteristic traps into which they fall. Number one, keeping the existing team too long. Some leaders clean house too precipitously, but it is more common to keep people longer than is wise. Whether because of hubris, these people have not performed well because they lacked a leader like me, or because they shy away from tough personnel calls, leaders end up with less than outstanding teams. This means they will either have to shoulder more of the load themselves or fall short of their goals. One experienced executive put it this way, "You always feel you can fix anything, but you can't. And you can't let personal issues fester. If some people on the team are not performing, their peers know it and your peers know it." A good rule of thumb is that you should decide by the end of your first 90 days who will remain and who will go. By the end of 6 months, you should have communicated your planned personnel changes to key stakeholders, especially your boss and HR. If you wait much longer, the team becomes yours, and change becomes increasingly difficult to justify and carry out. Naturally, the time frame depends on the STARS situation you are confronting. It may be shorter in a turnaround and longer in a sustained success situation. The key is to establish deadlines for reaching conclusions about your team and taking action within your 90-day plan, and then to stick to them. Number two, not repairing the airplane. Unless you are in a startup, you do not get to build a team from scratch. You inherit a team and have to mold it into what you need to achieve your A-item priorities. The process of molding a team is like repairing an airplane in mid-flight. You will not reach your destination if you ignore the necessary repairs, but you do not want to crash the airplane while trying to fix it. This situation can present a dilemma. It is essential to replace people, but some of them are essential to help run the business in the short run. What do? You develop options as quickly as you can. This may mean hiring people into temporary positions so they learn the ropes, or exploring whether people further down in the organization can meet the challenge. Number three, not working organizational alignment and team restructuring issues in parallel. A ship's captain cannot make the right choices about his crew without knowing the destination, the route, and the ship. Likewise, you can't build your team before reaching clarity about changes in strategy, structure, systems, and skills. Otherwise, you could end up with the right people in the wrong jobs. As Figure 7-1, which is in the PDF document file on the final CD of this program, illustrates, your efforts to assess the organization and achieve alignment should go on in parallel with assessment of the team and necessary personnel changes. Number four, not holding on to the good people. One experienced manager shared some hard-won lessons about the dangers of losing good people. When you shake the tree, she said, good people can fall out too. Her point is that uncertainty about who will and will not be on the team can lead your best people to make moves elsewhere. Although there are real constraints on what you can say about who will stay and who will go, you should look for ways to signal to the top performers that you recognize their capabilities. A little reassurance goes a long way. Number five, undertaking team building before the core team is in place. It is tempting to launch team-building activities such as joint problem-solving, brainstorming, and visioning right away. New leaders with a consensus-building style often are eager to tap the insights of their direct reports. But this approach poses a danger. It strengthens bonds in a group, some of whose members may be leaving. So avoid explicit team-building activities until the team you want is in place. This does not mean, of course, that you should avoid meeting as a group. Number 6, making implementation-dependent decisions too early. When successful implementation requires buy-in from your team, you should judiciously defer making decisions until its core members are in place. There will be decisions you cannot afford to delay, but it can be especially difficult to implement decisions that commit new people to courses of action they had no part in defining. So carefully weigh the benefits of moving quickly on major initiatives against the lost opportunity of gaining buy-in from the people you will bring on board later. Number 7, trying to do it all yourself. Finally, keep in mind that the process of restructuring a team is fraught with emotional, legal, and company policy complications. Do not try to undertake this on your own. Find out who can best advise you and help you chart a strategy. The support of a good HR person is indispensable to any effort to restructure a team. Assessing your existing team. You are likely to inherit some good performers, some average ones, and some who are simply not up to the job. You will also inherit a group with its own internal dynamics and politics. Some members may even have hoped for your job. During your first 30 to 60 days, you need to sort out who's who, what roles each individual plays, and how the group has worked in the past. Establish your criteria. You will inevitably find yourself forming impressions of team members as you meet them. Don't suppress these early reactions, but step back from them and undertake a more rigorous evaluation. The starting point is to be self-conscious about the criteria you will explicitly or implicitly use to evaluate people who report to you. Consider these 6 criteria. 1. Competence. Does this person have the technical competence and experience to do the job effectively? 2. Judgment. Does this person exercise good judgment, especially under pressure or when faced with making sacrifices for the greater good? 3. Energy. Does this team member bring the right kind of energy to the job, or is he or she burned out or disengaged? 4. Focus. Is this person capable of setting priorities and sticking to them, or prone to riding off in all directions? 5. Relationships. Does this individual get along with others on the team and support collective decision-making, or is he or she difficult to work with? 6. Trust. Can you trust this person to keep his or her word and follow through on commitments? To get a quick read on the criteria you use, fill out Table 7-1, which is in the PDF document on the final CD of this program. Allow yourself 100 points to divide among the 6 criteria according to the relative weight you place on them when you evaluate direct reports. Record those numbers in the middle column, making sure they add up to 100. Now identify one of these criteria as your threshold issue, meaning that if a person does not meet a basic threshold on that dimension, nothing else matters. Label your threshold issue with an asterisk in the right-hand column. Now, step back. Does this accurately represent the values you apply when you evaluate direct reports? If so, does this analysis suggest any potential blind spots in the way you evaluate people? Your assessments are likely to reflect certain assumptions about what you can and can't change in the people who work for you. If you score relationships low and judgment high, for example, you may think that relationships within your team are something you can influence, whereas you cannot influence judgment. Likewise, you may have designated trust as a threshold issue, many leaders do, because you believe that you must be able to trust those who work for you and because you think trustworthiness is a trait that cannot be changed. Factor in the situation. To what extent should your evaluative criteria vary depending on the situation you are facing? Potentially a lot. Suppose, for example, that you are taking a new job as Vice President of Sales, managing a geographically scattered group of regional sales managers. How would your criteria for evaluating people differ from those you would apply if you had been named to lead a new product development project? These jobs differ sharply in the extent to which your direct reports, number one, operate independently, and, number two, are dispersed geographically. If your direct reports operate more or less independently, their capacity to work together will be far less important than if you were managing an interdependent product development team. On the other hand, the fact that your people are geographically dispersed may restrict your ability to develop them. If so, you will want them to have threshold levels of competence and judgment. The criteria you apply may also depend on whether you are in a startup, turnaround, realignment, or a sustaining success situation. In a sustaining success situation, for example, you may have the time to develop one or two high-potential members of your team. In a turnaround, by contrast, you need people who can perform at a high level right away. Likewise, in a startup, you may be willing to trade off some trust for a higher level of energy and focus, whereas this would not be the case in a sustaining success situation. It is worthwhile to spend some time thinking about the criteria you will use to evaluate your new team. Having done so, you will be better prepared to make a rigorous and systematic evaluation. Assess your people. When you begin to assess each team member using the criteria you have developed, the first test is whether any of them fail to meet your threshold requirements. If so, begin planning to replace them. But merely surviving the basic hurdle does not mean they are keepers. Go on to the next step. Evaluate their strengths and weaknesses, factoring in the relative value you assign to each criterion. Now, who makes the grade and who does not? Meet one-on-one with each member of your new team as soon as possible. Depending on your style, these early meetings might take the form of informal discussions, formal reviews, or a combination. But your own preparation and focus should be standardized. Number one, prepare for each meeting. Review available personnel history, performance data, and other appraisals. Familiarize yourself with each person's technical or professional skills so you can assess how he or she functions on the team. Number two, ask probing questions. As we saw in Chapter 2 on learning, ask each person the same set of questions. For example, what do you think of our existing strategy? What are the biggest challenges and opportunities facing us in the short term? In the long term? What resources could we leverage more effectively? How could we improve the way the team works together? If you were in my position, what would you most want to pay attention to? Number three, look for verbal and nonverbal clues. Note choices of words, body language, and hot buttons. Notice what the individual does not say. Does the person volunteer information, or do you have to extract it? Does the person take responsibility for problems in his or her area? Make excuses? Blame others? How consistent are the individual's facial expressions and body language with his or her words? What topics elicit strong emotional responses? These hot buttons provide clues to what motivates the individual and what kinds of changes he or she would be energized by. Outside of these one-on-one meetings, notice how the individual relates to other team members. Do relations with other team members appear cordial and productive, tense and competitive, judgmental or reserved? Test their judgment. Make sure you are assessing judgment and not technical competence or raw intelligence. Some very bright people have lousy judgment, and some people of average competence have extraordinary judgment. It is essential to be clear about the mix of knowledge and judgment you need from key people. One way to assess judgment is to work with a person for an extended time and observe whether he or she is able to, 1, make sound predictions, and, 2, develop good strategies for avoiding problems. Both abilities draw on an individual's mental models, or ways of identifying the essential features and dynamics of emerging situations and translating those insights into effective action. This is what expert judgment is all about. The problem, of course, is that you don't have much time, and it can take a while to find out whether someone did or did not make good predictions. Fortunately, there are ways you can accelerate this process. One way is to test people's judgment in a domain in which feedback on their prediction abilities will emerge relatively quickly. Experiment with the following approach. Ask individuals whose judgment you want to evaluate about a topic that they are passionate about outside of work. It could be politics, or cooking, or baseball. It doesn't matter. Challenge them to make predictions. Who do you think is going to do better in the debate? What does it take to bake a perfect souffle? Which team will win the game tonight? Press them to commit themselves. Unwillingness to go out on a limb is a warning sign in itself. Then probe why they think their predictions are correct. Does the rationale make sense? If possible, follow up to see what happens. What you are testing is a person's capacity to exercise expert judgment in a particular domain. Someone who has become an expert in a private domain is likely to have done so in his or her chosen field of business, too, given enough passion about it. However you do it, the key is to find ways, beyond just waiting to see how people perform on the job, to probe for the hallmarks of expertise. Evaluate key functional people. If you are managing a team whose members have diverse functional expertise, such as marketing, finance, operations, and R&D, you will need to get a handle on their competence in their respective areas. This can be daunting, especially for first-time general managers. If you are an insider, try to solicit the opinions of people you respect and trust in each function who know the individuals on your team. If you are entering a general management role, consider developing your own evaluation template for each of the key functions. A good template consists of guidelines and warning signs for evaluating people in functions such as marketing, sales, finance, and operations. To develop each template, talk to experienced managers about what they look for in these functions. Assess the team as a whole. Besides evaluating individual team members, assess how the entire group works. Use these techniques for spotting problems in the team's overall dynamics. Number 1. Study the data. Read reports and team meeting minutes. If your organization conducts climate or morale surveys of individual units, examine these as well. Number 2. Systematically ask questions. Assess the individual responses to the common set of questions you asked when you met with the individual team members. Are their answers overly consistent? If so, this may suggest an agreed-on party line. But it could also mean that everyone genuinely shares the same impressions of what's going on. It will be up to you to evaluate what you observe. Do the responses show little consistency? If so, the team may lack coherence. Number 3. Probe group dynamics. Observe how the team interacts in your early meetings. Do you detect any alliances? Particular attitudes? Leadership roles? Who defers to whom on a given topic? When one person is speaking, do others roll their eyes or otherwise express disagreement or frustration? Pay attention to these signs to test your early insights and detect coalitions and conflicts. Restructuring your team. By now, your evaluation of individual team members' capabilities should have equipped you to figure out how best to deal with each person. Using the insights you've gained, assign each team member to one of the following categories. 1. Keep in place. The person is performing well in his or her current job. Number 2. Keep and develop. The individual needs development when time allows. Number 3. Move to another position. The person is a strong performer but is not in a position that makes the most of his or her skills or personal qualities. Number 4. Observe for a while. The individual requires watching and needs a personal development plan. Number 5. Replace. Low priority. The person should be replaced, but the situation is not urgent. Number 6. Replace. High priority. The person should be replaced as soon as possible. Consider alternatives to outright termination. You may be tempted to begin right away, letting go the people you have decided to replace. But take a moment first to consider alternatives. Letting an employee go can be difficult and time-consuming. Even if poor performance is well documented, the termination process can take months or longer. If there is no paper trail regarding poor performance, it will take time to document. Fortunately, you do have some alternatives. Often, a poor performer will decide to move on of his or her own accord in response to a clear message from you. Alternatively, you can work with human resources to shift the person to a more suitable position. Number 1. Move them laterally. Shift the person to a position on the team that better suits his or her skills. This is unlikely to be a permanent solution for a problem performer, but it can help you work through the short-term problem of keeping the organization running while you look for the right person to fill the slot. Number 2. Move the person elsewhere in the organization. Work with human resources to help the person find a suitable position in the larger organization. Sometimes, if handled well, this move can benefit you, the individual, and the organization overall. But don't pursue this solution unless you are genuinely convinced the person can perform well in the new situation. Simply shifting a problem performer onto someone else's shoulders will damage your reputation. Develop backups. To keep your team functioning while you build the best possible long-term configuration, you may need to keep an underperformer on the job while searching for a replacement. As soon as you are reasonably sure that someone is not going to make it, begin looking discreetly for a successor. Evaluate other people on your team and elsewhere in the organization for the potential to move up. Use skip-level meetings and regular reporting sessions to evaluate the talent pool. Ask human resources to launch a search. Treat people respectfully. During each phase of the team restructuring process, take pains to treat everyone with respect. Even if people in your unit agree that a particular person should be replaced, your reputation will suffer if they view your actions as unfair. Do what you can to show people the care with which you are assessing team members' capabilities and the fit between jobs and individuals. Your direct reports will form lasting impressions of you based on how you manage this part of your job. Aligning goals, incentives, and measures. Having the right people on the team is essential, but it's not enough. To achieve your A-item priorities and secure early wins, you will need to define how each team member can best support those key goals. This process calls for breaking down large goals into their component pieces and working with your team to assign responsibility for each element to a particular team member. Then it calls for making each individual accountable for managing his or her goals. How do you encourage accountability? The short answer is through effective incentives and clear criteria for measuring performance. Designing incentive systems. A blend of push and pull tools works best to motivate a team and shape behavior. See Figure 7-2, which is in the PDF document and the final CD of this program. Push tools, such as compensation plans, performance measurement systems, annual budgets, and the like, motivate people through authority, loyalty, fear, and expectation of reward for productive work. Pull tools, such as a compelling vision, inspire people by invoking a positive and exciting image of the future. The particular mix of tools you use will depend on your assessment of how people on your team prefer to be motivated. Your high-energy go-getters will probably respond most enthusiastically to pull incentives. With more methodical and risk-averse folks, push tools may prove more effective. How do you go about combining these two types of incentives? You have several options. A baseline question to ask yourself is how you will want to reward team members for achieving goals. What mix of monetary and non-monetary rewards will you employ? It is equally important to decide whether to base rewards on individual or collective performance. Do you need a high-performing team, or is a high-performing group enough? The distinction is an important one. If your direct reports work essentially independently, and the group's success hinges chiefly on individual achievement, you don't need to promote teamwork and should consider an individual incentive system. If success depends largely on cooperation among your direct reports and integration of their expertise, true teamwork is essential and you should use group goals and incentives to gain alignment. Usually, you will want to create incentives for both individual excellence, when your direct reports undertake independent tasks, and for team excellence, when they undertake interdependent tasks. The correct mix of individual and group rewards depends on the relative importance of independent and interdependent activity for the overall success of your unit. Designing incentive systems is a challenge, but the dangers of incentive misalignment are great. You need your direct reports to act as agents for you, whether they are undertaking individual responsibilities or collective ones. You don't want to give them incentives to pursue individual goals when true teamwork is necessary, or vice versa. The incentive equation. The incentive equation defines the mix of incentives that you will use to motivate desired performance. Here are the basic formulas. A. Total reward equals non-monetary reward plus monetary reward. The relative sizes of non-monetary and monetary reward depend on, number one, the availability of non-monetary rewards, such as advancement and recognition, and, number two, their perceived importance to the people involved. B. Monetary reward equals fixed compensation plus performance-based compensation. The relative sizes of fixed and performance-based compensation depend on, one, the extent of observability and measurability of people's contributions, and two, the time lag between performance and results. The lower the observability or measurability of contributions and longer the time lag, the more you should rely on fixed compensation. C. Performance-based compensation equals individual performance-based compensation plus group performance-based compensation. The relative sizes of individual and group-based performance compensation depend on the extent of interdependence of contributions. If superior performance comes from the sum of independent efforts, then individual performance should be rewarded, for example, in a sales group. If group cooperation and integration is critical, then group-based incentives should get more weight, for example, in a new product development team. Note that there may be several levels of group-based incentives: team, unit, and company as a whole. Defining performance metrics. Establishing and sticking to clear and explicit performance metrics is the best way to encourage accountability. That is, select performance measures that will let you know unambiguously whether a team member has achieved his or her goals. Avoid ambiguously defined goals, such as improved sales or decreased product development time. Instead, define goals in terms that can be quantified. For instance, increase sales of product X by 15 to 30% over the fourth quarter of this year, or decrease development time on product line Y from 12 months to 6 months within the next 2 years. Establishing new team processes. Once the team and their goals and incentives have been established, the next step is to think through how you want the team to work. That is, what processes will shape how the team gets its collective job done? Teams vary strikingly in how they handle meetings, make decisions, resolve conflict, and divide responsibilities and tasks. You will probably want to introduce new ways of doing things, but take care not to plunge into this task precipitously. First, familiarize yourself thoroughly with how your team worked before your arrival and how effective its processes were. That way you can preserve what worked well and change what did not. Assess your team's existing processes. How can you get a handle on your team's existing processes quickly? Talk to team members and support staff and to your new boss or your predecessor. Get them to brief you on their functions and walk you through the key processes. Read meeting minutes and team reports. Probe for answers to the following questions. 1. Participants' roles. Who influenced your predecessor most? Who played devil's advocate? Who was the innovator? Who avoided uncertainty? To whom did everyone else listen most attentively? Who was the peacemaker? The rabble-rouser? Team meetings. How often did your team meet? Who participated? Who set the agendas for the meetings? Decision-making. Who made what kinds of decisions? Who was consulted on decisions? Who was told once decisions were made? Leadership style. What leadership style did your predecessor prefer? That is, how did he or she prefer to learn, communicate, motivate, and handle decisions? How does your predecessor's leadership style compare with yours? If your styles differ markedly, how will you address the likely impact of those differences on your team? Target processes for change. Once you grasp how your team functioned in the past, and what did and did not work well, it is time to use what you have learned and establish the new processes you judge necessary. Many leaders decide, for example, that their team's meeting and decision-making processes would benefit from revision. If this is true of you, begin spelling out in specific terms what changes you envision. How often will the team meet? Who will attend which meetings? How will agendas be established and circulated? Setting up clear and effective processes will help your team coalesce and secure some early wins as a group.